Dear participants, you are most welcome to our webinar. We are excited to begin this webinar, which has over 200 participants, registered participants from all over Europe and Finland especially. And my name is Päivi Farikov, and I'm working here as a facilitator of this interdisciplinary collaboration of well-being related sciences in the University of Jyväskylä. And we will have four very interesting presentations from top presenters from four different countries, and I hope we will all learn a lot today. And we will be able to discuss on our digital platform in addition to the discussion here. Each presentation has a separate commentary from an expert commentary, but you are also able to comment by raising your hand or using the digital platform that we have provided for you. Each of you has received a separate personal link to that website. Please use that as well. And now it is my great pleasure to invite to the floor the distinguished Professor Aila-Leena Matiis. She's a professor of social work at our university, and she is the one who initiated this webinar. Welcome, Aila-Leena.
Thank you, Päivi, and hello, everybody. You are really warmly welcome to this event, and I have to say that it's really delighting to see this broad interest in the topic of our webinar today. Päivi already introduced my background. I have been also a member in this interdisciplinary community of well-being researchers of our university organizing this webinar. And the reason why we wanted to organize this webinar stems from the observation that although European welfare states have very different, even contrasting models and systems of organizing social and health services, they all seem to be in similar deep crises. And this is somehow very surprising and astounding. And the crises share common features like they are all, but the first is, of course, the ticking demographic time bomb, the aging population. Secondly, the shortage of qualified staff in most professions working in these services, from carers and nurses to social workers, psychologists, and medical doctors. At the same time, all kinds of European service systems are facing financial crises, and nowadays also increasingly accompanied by political winds that want just to cut public spending and not reform them. In this imbalance between growing needs and reducing resources, service policies tend to search for applicable new models from other countries. Take the example of Finland, which recently underwent a historic reform that transferred public social health and emergency services from around 300 municipalities to the responsibility of 21 welfare regions, or well-being regions, depends a little bit how to translate it. Direct quote from the Ministry of Social Affairs and Health in Finland: "The reform was needed to ensure equal services, narrow the differences in welfare and health among our population, and curb the growth of costs." The core promise how this should be achieved was the reform had that was the integration of social and health services to work better together, to work seamlessly in any client case and also at the higher level or broader level of populations. However, faced with the growing shortage of professional, especially medical doctors, in the public services. Finland is now starting to run a new program of private family doctors, which is a little bit against this idea of integration. And it's argued with references to other countries, such as Denmark and also Germany. However, as we will hear from Sonja Lack today, there are attempts in Germany to reform their system, the same system, because of its problems, and to replace it with a more multi-professional system. So this is such an example of this not so clearly research-based searching ideas from other countries. So this is why we think that this kind of discussion platform is needed and necessary to share and promote scientific results and collected information, so that European national systems of social and health services can learn from each other. And learn from successes and failures. We wish us a very fruitful and rich afternoon with many new insights that will be usable and useful for co-creating sustainable systems of social and health services together with praxis and interdisciplinary research. So thank you for coming, and let's see what we learn during this afternoon.
And now I would like to give the floor or the screen to John Blaspie, who comes from United Kingdom, and he is the director of IMPACT, meaning Improving Adult Care Together. So welcome, John.
Thank you very much for that introduction, and thank you everybody for inviting me to be part of such a wonderful workshop today. I'm just going to share my slides a moment, so I will bring those up. Hopefully, those have appeared on the screen for you now, everybody. So yes, as colleagues said, my name's John Glasby. I'm based in Birmingham in the centre of the UK, and I lead a national UK-wide centre called IMPACT, which is the UK centre for implementing evidence in adult social care. So trying to respond to some of those challenges that were just summarised, but through using evidence to try and improve services and to help them to respond to the opportunities and the challenges that we face. I trained as a social worker in Birmingham, and when I was training, someone who went on to be very senior in social care said to me, "You'll make a good social worker, John. The trouble is you think too much." Now, I know what they meant. I'm sure I was a very irritating student. Sometimes you can't ask too many questions at once, can you? Sometimes you have to ask questions in the way that the other person can hear. Sometimes you have to earn the right to ask questions. But I think the young me was trying to say, why are services the way they are? How could they be different? And how could I play a role in making them better in the future? And those are questions I hope we would all ask ourselves in our different countries and our different roles. And the way that the response was framed was really interesting. You think too much. You know, with something as important as social work, or indeed healthcare, something that touches our lives in such important ways, how could you ever possibly think too much about it? I also wonder if it's something that we would have said to a different kind of welfare professional, to a doctor, for example, where thinking about things is quite important. So in English social care anyway, there's quite a divide traditionally between people in practice and then people in research, and that there's often not much overlap or dialogue between the two. And so we lose the opportunity to use evidence to make a practical difference. So IMPACT, the centre that I lead, stands for Improving Adult Care Together, and we were very fortunate to win a £15 million national tender from two national UK funders, the Economic and Social Research Council and the Health Foundation, to design and to deliver a new UK-wide centre. So we work across all four nations of the UK to get evidence of what works, used in practice, to make a difference to services and to people's lives. When we talk about evidence of what works, we've got quite an inclusive, quite a diverse definition of evidence. So we mean insights from different types of research, but also from the lived. Oh.
John, let me your slides don't change, just
Ah,
let you know.
thank you. That's helpful. I'll stop sharing and try and reshare them just to see if that makes any difference. I do apologize, colleagues. They weren't that good in the first place, but I should at least try to make them change. Let me try afresh. Okay, maybe if I just talk and so I don't take up too much of your time, I'm happy to send through the slides. And I do apologize, colleagues. Care technology is actually one of the themes that we work with, which is ironic given my own technology hasn't worked very well today. So IMPACT works across the UK to get evidence used in practice. And our definition of evidence is a very broad one. It would include insights from different types of research, but also from the lived experience of people who draw on care and support or who are unpaid carers, and from the practice knowledge of people who work in different parts of social care. And we would see those three ways of knowing the world, research, lived experience, and practice knowledge, all as important in their own right. And you just need to kind of bring those together and to triangulate them and then to work with them in practical terms as you're bringing people together from different backgrounds to hopefully work on common solutions to some of the problems that were described at the beginning of this workshop. Now, we've got four key delivery models that I'll talk you through in a moment. But effectively, our work takes the form of local projects in the workplace all over the UK. So we're a very distributed centre with staff based in some of the locations on the map, but all over England, Wales, Scotland, and Northern Ireland, each taking forward a practical, evidence-informed change project in the reality of local services. And then when we produce some learning from that project, we then try to find ways to get that shared with other people, not just by telling people about the innovation, but by trying to find ways of getting it built into national policy and practice. We call that national embedding, so that we're trying to scale innovation by getting it built into how adult social care gets done, not just by telling people about it. Really briefly, we've got four key aims: to increase the use of evidence in adult social care, leading to better care and outcomes, to build capacity and skills in the workforce, to develop relationships in a sector that can often be quite fragmented, and in the process, to improve understanding of what helps and what hinders implementation in practice. We happen to work in adult social care and in the UK, but hopefully the lessons that we're starting to learn are relevant for other colleagues in other nations and in other parts of our health and social services. Really briefly, we've got four key delivery models that help us do that. For big strategic change initiatives, we have a series of impact demonstrators, and each demonstrator has a pair of senior coaches who work in a service or in an area of the country for 12 months to help lead an evidence-informed change project, often quite a large project. Those colleagues would be senior, they'd be very experienced, and they would have skills in terms of implementation, organisational development, and change management. They wouldn't be academic research posts. These are people from a leadership background, a management background, a consultancy background who can support practical changes in the workplace. So, one of our recent projects has been looking at how you manage waiting lists in adult social care, for example, working across 10 of our municipalities in part of England. Another project recently has been looking at how you increase choice and control for people with learning disabilities so that they can receive more individualised funding to fund to control their own care, based across the Department of Health in Northern Ireland. and so on and so forth. They're quite big, quite strategic change initiatives. Our impact facilitators then is they're a more junior colleague, a single colleague working for 12 months in a frontline organization, usually leading a smaller or a more bottom-up evidence-informed change project. Just as an example, one of our recent projects has been looking at how you try and recruit more men into care careers in the UK, working with a service provider that supports young men with a brain injury. And helping that organisation use evidence to change how it recruits and retains staff so that it can recruit more male members of staff so that some of the people who use services have more of a choice over who supports them. For complex but everyday practice issues, we have a series of impact networks, and those are local groups all over the United Kingdom made up of service users, carers, practitioners, and managers. Who work on a local the same local issue in their local area. They get some evidence from us to start them off, and they go through quite a structured way of meeting and feeding back over 6 months, how well they measured up to the evidence, what they're going to do in response, what barriers they faced, how they got round them, what they're going to do next. And after each meeting, they share those thoughts with our central team, who collect that together from all the local groups. And send it back out before the next meeting, so that the local group is doing is taking practical action in the local area, but the learning is scaling across the UK across the course of the network. That was a way of working actually developed in Sweden by a national carers organisation called NKA, who described them as blended learning networks, and they were very helpful in helping us to use a similar model in the UK. And then finally, our Ask Impact team identify hot topics or important issues in social care, and they produce rigorous but very simple and practical guides to the evidence to help people in frontline practice understand what the evidence has to say. One of our recent guides was around how you best support older people who are coming out of hospital and have ongoing care needs in the community. Making sure that you focus on things that really matter to older people and to families, but that our health and social services can sometimes overlook when the hospital is under a lot of pressure, just to give you an example. Now, really briefly, I just wanted to share two or three things that we've been learning from some of that work. And these broader themes might be more relevant for today's workshop than the detail of what the centre actually does. I'll put the details in the chat afterwards in case colleagues want to follow up around individual projects or the centre more generally. But it may be that what we're learning about evidence, about co-production, and about implementation is more important or more helpful today. So, in terms of our approach to evidence, as I said earlier, we draw on insights from research, from lived experience, and from practice knowledge. And when we were designing Impact, people told us that some forms of research were already seen as quite powerful forms of evidence, particularly economic and quantitative forms of research. So that if we were going to value research, lived experience, and practice knowledge, we would need to turn the volume up on lived experience and on practice knowledge, because those were sometimes seen as a less valid form of knowledge in their own right. Some approaches to these issues have a hierarchy of evidence that imply that one particular method is somehow better than others. Whilst we've argued that there isn't a best approach, it depends what you want to know as to what's a good way of finding it out. If I wanted to take a new medication or to have a new surgical procedure, I would want it to have been tested with a series of randomized controlled trials and summarized in a systematic review, because that's a really good way of researching some of those interventions. If I wanted to know what it felt like to start to suffer a serious mental health problem and then to be forcibly admitted to a mental health hospital, and to know how best to support people so that that was as untraumatizing as possible, I might talk to some people who've been admitted to a mental health hospital or their family or staff. I might watch as people were admitted. I'd go about answering the question in a different way. And academically, some of these debates about hierarchies of evidence are based on assumptions that if you're distant from the topic you're researching, then you are more neutral and more objective. That's how randomized control trials work. They try and control as much of it as possible so that the finding you produce is genuinely the finding. There are other insights, though, from feminist and from disability research that say the further you are away from something, that the more there's a greater risk that you misunderstand it. So that for some things it's helpful to be distant, but for other things it's helpful to be quite close up to make sure you really understand the thing that you're talking about and trying to understand. Now, all this might sound really boring in the opening presentation, but it's not a philosophical debate about the nature of knowledge. It's actually a debate about which voices get heard when we talk about how to reform our services and which voices get excluded. It's really a discussion about power and about expertise. Now, that's an important statement that we try and live out in all our work, and lived experience is built into everything we do at Impact. But you then need really practical ways of working to make that real so that you can review those types of evidence, you can help people draw down those insights and make practical changes and so on. The second thing we wanted to share was around co-production. And we take the definition from a national organisation in the UK called the Social Care Institute for Excellence, often abbreviated to SCIE, SCIE. And they describe co-production as people who draw on care and support and carers working with professionals in equal partnership towards shared goals. Now, we try and build lived experience into everything that we do, into our staff team, into our definition of evidence, into our leadership team, into the way we're governed and make decisions. And about 50% of our staff say that they have lived experience of care and support, for example, and that would include all our staff, not just staff who are in delivery roles. So probably about half our staff at any one time would have lived experience of adult social care. Many people would have worked in social care at different stages of their careers as well. And we have various governance mechanisms in place that provide additional support, but also challenge to help us learn about co-production, but also to make sure that we're living out our values. And we've learned over time that co-production isn't an end point that you ever reach. It's a journey that you go on together. And what matters is time, is building relationships, is making progress together. And you also have to be really committed and really very skilled if you're going to work in a very inclusive way. And if you're going to identify and try and work around some of the power imbalances that might exist between people who work in adult social care services, for example, and people who use those services or those families, it's you have to work with power and power imbalances. And we've also found ourselves often being a critical friend to the system. I don't know if that translates very well from English, but the idea of being first and foremost a friend, trying to help services be as good as they can be and to improve and to make a difference to people, but also sometimes needing to be a little bit critical and challenging to ask difficult questions. And so being a critical friend is a kind of spectrum, and sometimes you're sharing good practice and you're modeling good practice and you're supporting, but other times if something isn't good enough, or maybe some of the commitments to co-production don't feel very real, you have to say so and kind of call it out and to be a little bit challenging as well. And maybe sometimes you earn the right to be challenging by being a good partner and a good ally. And then the final theme that I was going to share today was around implementation more generally. When we have new ways of working or evidence of what works, how do you go about actually helping people to make practical changes in response? And when we were designing Impact, people told us that they'd got policy that told them what they ought to be doing, and they'd got growing amounts of research that gave them a sense of things that might be helpful. But the hard bit, the bit that everybody is struggling with, is how do you actually do it for real? So those delivery models that I was describing earlier are really about practical support in the realities of the workplace, to think about what the evidence might be saying, to try and do something different in response to that evidence, and then to work out what is and isn't making a difference. It's a really practical form of learning by doing in the realities of frontline services. And it's that practical support that, in the UK at least, people told us they really valued and they were really missing. Now, doing that requires a completely different skill set. I was a social worker. I'm now a professor at a university. This isn't the sort of things that professors are normally very good at, because you get promoted because of a certain kind of skill set, and certain skills are kind of prioritized as you develop your career. This is about working in frontline services, about engaging with people, about managing change, about leadership, about organizational development and change management skills. It's a completely different skill set to being a research fellow or a senior research fellow. We try and scale the innovation that we find and that we support through our approach to national embedding. And we're a very small centre, in spite of the size of the grant that we won. So you have to be really strategic and really focused about how you develop those relationships. And you have to plan in the opportunity to scale and to influence from the beginning. A number of colleagues will carry out a research project, and then they'll think about how to implement it as if those are two separate phases, whilst really researching and implementing are two sides of the same coin, if that phrase from English translates well for colleagues. So you have to be really strategic when you're thinking about implementation. But sometimes and it sounds like a contradiction, but you also have to be a little bit flexible and opportunistic as well. Sometimes something just happens in national policy, and you have to be in the right place at the right time and have the right relationships to be able to use some of the learning that you have to be able to influence. So you have to have a plan. But you also have to ignore the plan and do something different if the opportunity arises. And you have to be able to do both of those at the same time. Sometimes that's luck. You're just in the right place at the right time. Sometimes you sort of make your own luck a little bit as well. And one colleague described it to us at the start as being on the call sheet. And we were thinking about a new government in the UK and how we would prepare. And they said, well, what's really important is that you're on the call sheet of the people who are going to be making decisions, so that when they don't know what to do, you're one of the people that they call for informal advice. And I thought that was quite a nice way of thinking about the work that we all do on the call today, about being on the call sheet of people who might need our support to make a difference. I have some colleagues who think that evidence gives you an answer. And in my experience, it seldom gives you an answer. It often gives you more questions, but it gives you as well a route into a conversation or a dialogue or a process of co-creation as you try and work out what the evidence means and what you could do about it together. And I also have some colleagues who think that implementation is a one-off event, that something isn't implemented on Monday. You implement it on Tuesday, and then on Wednesday, it's implemented. And I think in the real world, implementation is an ongoing process. It's not a one-off event. Now, all this, I think I would say, works best. And the colleague who started the presentation today said this really well. It works best when we can tie the evidence of what works into people's motives and their values, the reason that they came into the job in the first place, the difference that they want to make to people's lives, the lives that people want to lead. If we can do that, then evidence of what works can become a tool to help you achieve what you want to achieve as a social worker or a nurse or a doctor. It's not an extra task that someone is telling you you have to engage with on top of the 101 other things you also have to engage with. It's part of the solution. It's a means to an end. So we try to make the case for evidence by showing that it can make a practical difference and that it can help, not by constantly talking about evidence. And sometimes in that process, as I said earlier, you have to be quite challenging, but you also earn the right to be quite challenging through people knowing that you understand the sector, that you're on their side, that you're trying to help, that you're part of a solution to the challenges that we heard at the start of today's workshop. So I'll finish there, and really happy to share my slides with the organisers so that people can see them. I'm sorry for the technical hitch. I'll put the details of the website and my email as well into the chat as well. But just to finish and to reflect and to go back to where we started, we have an internal and an external evaluation to demonstrate whether we're making a difference as a centre. And there's lots of performance measures and targets and pieces of data that we have to collect. But deep down, if a centre like Impact was successful in the UK or something similar in another nation, we'd know that we were successful when the next time a young, slightly naive, probably slightly irritating social work student said, "Well, why do we do it like that?" We'd be successful if the team manager said, "Well, the reason we do it like that, John, is because there's really good evidence from the research, from people's lived experience, and from our practice knowledge that that is a good way of delivering that kind of support." And to me, that is what success looks like. And that is how we will navigate and respond to all the challenges that we started the seminar with today. So thank you very much indeed for the invitation. I'll stop sharing, even though it wasn't working, and I'll hand back to the organisers.
Thank you. Thank you. It was really inspiring, and I think we all learned a lot. But now, before other comments, I would like to invite Anu Peel, the Director of Strategy of the Wellbeing Services County of Central Finland, to give a few comments. Are you there, Anu?
Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Yeah, I'm slightly mad here because I had a huge, massive computer program since our ITC system had removed my Zoom. So I didn't. I'm so sorry that I couldn't hear all of Mr. Glasby, your speech. But luckily, I saw the slides few hours before your presentation. I got to get to know your content, but few comments that I would like to talk really about many things that you brought up in your presentation. The part that I heard, one is leadership. The another is like a change resistance that I heard in your speech, that even though we have strong evidence about things that really work, in that it might show like to a social worker that you're going to change the way I'm working and my way of working. I'm so proud of the way I work. It used to be like a good way, so what I'm doing wrong now, and it might cause like the change resistance, and about the implementing process and how easy it is to go back to the old ways. Since we have had this huge organizational transformation in Finland in social and healthcare and rescue services, and we have actually faced a lot of this change resistance since talking about good ways of working, and we should do in we used to have 22 municipalities here in central Finland, and now we should choose one, the best way, and how to make it visible that, okay, your way isn't like wrong way, but we have better ways to do it. So it was very fascinating that how you do the implementation and convince the workers that, which is that my feeling about my work and then the studies and here is the like a strong connection between studying and that the people who are working actually in the field with people. And this is I see that this is a really great opportunity to like engage research and the basic work with the clients, also in social care, since the healthcare system has done this maybe a little bit longer time, and we are like coming a little bit from the back side of this evidence. Another thing which like really inspired me was this idea of doing this together. We are talking about, we have this concept of collective impact. Since you were talking about impact and research and evidence-based work, and we are using the collective impact, even though we are a huge organization, we cannot do this alone. We need NGOs, we need municipalities, we need other governmental organizations, we need the researchers, we need the whole package to help the complex issues of our clients. So together and in this collective impact scene, the how you talked about doing this together and finding the same goal and same target. And that was really inspiring about your presentation. So thank you for that. So maybe those few comments from my perspective. and maybe some other people have some other comments.
Thank you, Anu. I think there is time for one or two short comments, and maybe time for you to respond. We also have a possibility to comment and discuss these issues on our digital platform. Please join that as well, and it will be open about to the end of this month. But do you want to respond, John?
Yeah, thank you. And thank you, Anu. I agree with all that. I love the idea of the kind of practical support and overcoming kind of professional resistance. And I love the idea of collective impact. And a lot of the work is around, I think there's two things. One is it's around facilitation. It's bringing people together from different backgrounds who have different values and skills, and then trying to kind of understand the problem and some of the possible ways forward, and then trying to build those relationships. And in the UK, adult social care is quite a fragmented sector. There's quite a lot of competition and very, very passionately held but different views about what a good outcome would look like. So we, I think we play quite an important role as an independent centre in helping to broker and convene some of those relationships. So we're good friends with most people, even if they're not friends with each other, they're often friends with us, and we can kind of act as a bit of a bridge sometimes. So that work, I think, is quite skilled and it's exhausting, but it's quite important as well to bring people together, because somebody in the room will have the answer. It's or together we'll be able to find an answer, but it's trying to bring people together. And then we've, in terms of overcoming resistance, we found that this works best on topics that people really, really care about and that they want to solve, but where nobody really knows the answer yet. And sometimes the evidence can just help you think differently about it, or to go about it a bit differently, and maybe make more progress than you would otherwise. So I've been doing some research in my university role about the experience of people with learning disabilities and autistic people in some of our who are sometimes in secure hospital settings, trying to come out of those hospitals and to lead more ordinary lives in the community. There's about 2,000 people in England who are still in a long stay hospital at any one time. And I've never met a nurse or a doctor or a social worker who wants to lock people with learning disabilities in hospitals. They all want people to come out and to live better lives in the community. It's just we don't know how to do it very well. And actually, maybe the evidence can give you something slightly different that you could do to try and make that more of a reality for people. So, you know, there's always resistance, but it sometimes works best when you've got those relationships to build on, and when you're genuinely trying to find a collective solution for things that we all care about, but we don't really know what to do, because then we're not criticizing each other. We're looking for solutions together. And so I agreed exactly with what you said about collective input as well.
Yeah, that's true, because I think that as in UK, also in Finland, we have some issues that we haven't solved yet. Yeah, that's a good point. Thank you.
Yeah, I think there
And
might
it's
be
often
some
it's often sorry
discussion.
it's often because they're really hard as well, isn't it? I know that sounds really simple, but if they're easy, we'd have solved them by now. You know, the ones that are still left are the ones that are really hard. So, you know, that's why people need the help. Otherwise, they could do it themselves. So I do think that's right. Yeah.
That's right. The easy things have been done already. Thank you. This was inspiring start for our webinar, and I would now like to introduce Sonja Laak, who is from the Institute for Care, Aging and Health think tank, IPAC. How do you pronounce that? I'm not sure. Can you please, Sonja, help us with that?
Okay, hello everybody. And yeah, thank you for the invitation. And I think one challenge is to share the slides. I will try immediately. Have a look. So welcome. Yeah, my name is Sonja Laak from Germany. And when Ailalena asked me to have a presentation here, I said, I'm not a researcher. My main job is working at a health insurance, a statutory health insurance company, and but I watch research a lot. And I founded by a hobby a think tank because our healthcare system in Germany is quite medical doctor centered. And Ayla Lena told me, as she said in the introduction words, Finland is going to have a private family doctor system. And yeah, what can I bring to this session is our experience in Germany the last 130 years by a medical doctor center system. It's the called Bismarck system. We have in the typology of healthcare systems these ends. One is the Bismarck system and the other end is the Beveridge system. And I think over the 100 years ago, it has become very mixed up. And to explain German healthcare system in only in German language is quite challenging, and do it in English, yeah, is even I think more experience. Okay, let's try to get you introduced into the system and into our think tank. The think tank, just a few words about us. Who are we? We are, as I said, we are not researchers. We are, some of them are researchers. We are a mixed up group. A classical grassroots movement. Melanie and I founded this think tank because we said nobody in this country looks on the structure, on the healthcare system. And as we are just voluntarily on our way, we do not need money, we do not need jobs and something else. We are very free to say what we think. And this is, yeah, gives us a lot of freedom. We are roughly about 70 members. As I said, we are all on hobby in this way. We had a starting point from our nursing system. Many of us were or are in the nursing care on the way, but we grow into professional, and this is what we want. We have now freelancing, consulting in municipalities. We have social care workers. We have scientists from different disciplines, lawyers, politicians, and people like me who work in the administration. What do we do? We had a starting concept, CareShare 13. I will present this. And we shape this concept by public discussions. We presented the first draft of our concept in July 2 years ago, and we have video calls, we publish and we shape it by other people, and our think tank is growing with people who fit in. And yeah, we talk a lot to a lot of people, and I'm very happy to present this concept now in this round here. So, system, when I saw the title, what is the system? System, healthcare system, for me, it's architecture. I love this, all these documentaries about Notre Dame, and you can see how in the Middle Age, the builders and the architects, what they were thinking about, building such a system, actually. And this has so many bits and pieces and parts, and this is the, how to say, the level we are in the think tank on the way. And this is very hard to express or to explain to other people that a healthcare system or a social care system has an architecture. And architecture is not only having stones built together, its expression is form, style, technology, function, and of course, a lot of culture. I loved was what John Gatsby said about research and evaluation. We have a lot of research in Germany the last 30 years, but it becomes more and more, as I call it, a prêt-à-porter research, because there's only one method, randomized controlled studies, and with that is everything explained. And this is where I very disagree. So the German healthcare system. This is my favorite slide. I always, usually health economists would never wide up the eye on the whole range of our grown social law. Health economists usually have the social code, the as we call it, SGB V, the big pillar health insurance, where I have a quantifier from Bismarck on it. This is our healthcare system. And over the last 130 years, they have the social law, which is unemployment, insurance, welfare aid for lower incomes, children and youth, rehabilitation, occupational accidents, and elder care. Every pillar has grown in is its own thought and its own regulations. And in every pillar, there is new invented how to serve, how to look on health and social care and caring and nursing care. So this is the how to say the architecture, the main architecture of the German healthcare system. And of course, in when it comes to healthcare and social care providing, it's not seamless. Yeah, we have so many how to say so many bridges which are not bridges, so many holes patients fall down, and it's all put or it's all to refer to this architecture. And these pillars are usually they have two how to say who ends. It is the sort we care. The care is performed and how it is financed. And this is, after 130 years, a whole mess, to say it in easy words. So this is the Bismarck healthcare system, and this is a doctor-centered, medical doctor-centered system, because when the Bismarck system, when Bismarck installed the health insurance, there were already 20,000 health insurance companies. And with Bismarck, there comes the law that certain people and certain professions and employees have to be insured. And at that time, the doctors were becoming professional. They built up their associations, and the statutory health insurance and the doctors made a contract. And this contract, the collective contract, as we say it, is still existing. This is, as I say, the motorway of healthcare in Germany. And the way we do regulation and organize and how to look on healthcare is just, yeah, it's all by doctors and insurance companies put together. And this is what we called mode of Selbstverwaltung, it's self-government. The law frame comes from the national side, from the Bundesgesundheitsministerium, but the self-government, insurance companies, the insurance system, and the doctors, they made the regulations, they fill it out. And this one detail, 90% of German population is insured by a statutory healthcare insurance system, and 10% are private insured. And this is just history, because in the Bismarck 1883, when the system started, it was said people who are self-employed and people who are in servant, who are public servants, Beamte, teachers, professors at the universities, they can pay their doctor's bills themselves. They don't need an insurance system. And it is grown until this 90 and 10%. And the very problematic thing about this is that for the 10% of this German population, the medical doctors have an own tax fee. So they can charge medical treatment higher than for the statutory insured people. And this is the only topic one sometimes can see this concerns German politicians. And yeah, this is a very crude system, a very crude grown system. And what is the problems? I will give you only five of that. What happened over the 130 years until now, because it hasn't changed anything. The focus on this Bismarck system is totally on disease and pathogenesis, and not on health and salutogenesis, not on prevention, not on public health. Every attention goes into treating disease. We have in Germany no culture of health promotion. The worst thing, I think, is that we do not have any connection from the professional medical and insurance system to the counties, to the cities, to the municipalities, municipalities, to the communal and regional area, just where the people live. Social care and all the other social codes books, as I showed up before in the pillars, they are a totally different universe. So if you look on a person who is unemployed, a long-term unemployed person, we put them between the systems like a flipper bowl, because we don't provide health and social care in one, as we say, in one fit. And the financing systems, of course, makes a lot of problem because you finance what you are meant to be. And the healthcare system is just meant to be to pay doctor's treatment. A third big problem is all other health and social care professions. We call them in Germany, it's a very common used term, non-doctors professions, which is very, discriminating. And I think it's already very well known that German nursing system and the German nursing profession is hardly no existing, because the rules how nurses, who are a basic provider, of course, they are allowed to do what the doctor's regulation said, or the elder care financing system. And what comes up is they have no profession law, no really update profession law. If you want to have a physiotherapy or a nurse who puts the compression stockings on, it has to be prescribed at least by the doctors. And this is a real big problem. We are 100 years behind other countries about that. We don't have any academic physiotherapists or nurses. It's 1% of our nurses are academic educated, and they are working mostly in management. One further big problem is the expensive hospital providing, because of this collective contract, which is the highway in German healthcare system. It's a road, a highway on itself, and it has no connection to the hospital part. And avoiding hospital admissions is a very big target, but we never reach this because we don't do prevention, because we don't do proper outpatient care. And at least it is totally seamless. And we have no patient-centered care because we do not have any healthcare planning in Germany. We don't plan regions or welfare regions. What we do is we count hospital beds and the number of residential doctors. There is no planning at all. And describing this old system, you can imagine what I will go for to present healthcare, the care share system 13. The bureaucracy, which is a problem, I think, in all nations. We will never get rid of bureaucracy, because if the tectonic of the system is not proper set up. So, what is this 13? We say in our concept, we have to do a law lifting. We have to look where is all the healthcare regulation redundant? Where are we doubling a lot of regulations? Every pillar of it has an own medical service. So this is ridiculous. And we have to lift this up and to make a new social code book with a new organization, a new view of organization. And that refers to the way we finance healthcare and social care as well. And this is, of course, you can imagine this is would be hard work. But all the reforms and transformation activities we had the last 30, 40 years, they never go on to this architecture. They reform and reform, but they never go to the root of the problem. And this is what we call and want to do. The heart of the CareShare 13 is making a new system hardware. And this is regional CareShare Circle as a new governance architecture for CareShare planning, interprofessional, regional, population-based. We need shared leadership. We need not only health insurance companies and doctors, medical doctor associations. We need a multidisciplinary shared leadership. And we need new contracts, shared care contracts and single catalogs for monoprofessional, doing, working, offering support. And I think it's already known that Germany is not on the first by the digital revolution. We are very much behind. And the reason for that is that the whole digital approach, when it comes up 20 years ago in Germany, it was treated like a subject which healthcare insurance and medical doctors have to deal with. And this is actually it's infrastructure, and we don't have the institutional setup to think this. And this is what we say, the new architecture has to be designed and to be installed by a digital design. And this is quite a challenge. So, of course, John Gatsby said we are transforming actually every day. And if we do not reform or transform, we will be transformed. And what happens in Germany is quite, if you do not know where you want to go or to drive, you don't need a GPS, because what will what will you install? Which target will you install? And of course, for politicians, it's very hard. They get elected by things they do and people see. They don't get elected. They won't be elected by things that will, show off and will be sold out in future times. And this is, I think, a very big problem in politics, to think in long-term architecture things. I hope you could understand what I was talking. And that was it. So I
Sure. Well,
thanks.
thank you, Sonia. It was really great to hear this, and gave, I think, at least to me, a lot to think about the differences. There is somebody raising hand, but I think I will first give the floor to Heikki Hiilamo, who is our agreed commentator to this, professor of social policy. In Department of Social Research at the University of Helsinki, and he is also a research professor of the Finnish Institute for Health and Welfare, so in a double position. And welcome, Heikki.
Thank you. I hope you can hear me.
Yes.
Yeah, so thank you very much for this opportunity. This opportunity to get to know this new model you're suggesting for Germany. I haven't heard about this initiative before. I have some knowledge about way system works in Germany, since one of my best friends is a medical doctor in Germany. And I know that the medical profession has a very strong position in the German system, as you illustrated. I think it has to do with the development of the medical, very quick development of the medical fields, like invention of new medicines and new treatments at the time when this system was established. And ever since, there has been new innovations also in social work, social care, also in mental health and in other professions, and they are not always recognized by the medical doctors, and that's a big problem. I also consulted on some social issues to Georgia, and over there I have been working with a colleague from Germany, and he has presented the German social code as a very progressive model for other countries to adopt. And I think your social code is very progressive, since it's such a comprehensive legislation. Everything is in the one law, and that is not the case in Finland. So we have, I mean, many of the things which you are proposing for Germany, they have already been implemented in Finland through our social and healthcare reform. So we have all, in terms of finances, most of the financing is just coming from taxes, and it's been channeled to social and healthcare regions or well-being regions, which are responsible for organizing both social and healthcare services, both on primary care level and expert or tertiary level. So that has been already implemented in Finland in that sense, but we still have separate legislations for the provision of services. Like we have a separate legislation for health services, for social services, for services for disabled persons, services for the elderly, and I think that would be a very good model for us to adapt, to put everything in the same piece of legislation as you have it in Germany. And one thing I would like to emphasize in my comment is something which you didn't talk so much about in your talk, but if I understood correctly, your initiative would give quite a lot of autonomy for the Bundesländer, for the regions, and I think that's also an important point for Finland, since currently the well-being regions have no financial autonomy at all. All the money is coming from the Ministry of Finance, and you could say that the state is actually organizing the services through the regions. The regions, they have democratically elected representatives, but the representatives have very little to say about the finances, they are very much many people are frustrated, and we're going to have a new election for the representatives in the regions and also in the municipalities in few weeks' time, and many people don't want to recandidate because of the frustration. So I think that's a very good idea to have autonomy for the regions, also in terms of finances and also in terms of provision. You also talked quite a lot about how to integrate healthcare and long-term care, and that's a big topic of discussion for Finland, since our population is aging perhaps more rapidly currently than in any other European country, a big part of the increasing costs of social and healthcare are coming from from long-term care. And I think that's an area where we could also improve and perhaps introduce better services and treatments and integration. And finally, I would like to talk about the issue which you also mentioned, which is health promotion. We also could, if we include the social services, we could also talk about promotion of well-being. And that's really the weak link in our system. I mean, Finland was a pioneering country in the 70s in introducing health promotion into our primary care system. But since then, we have somehow neglected this area. And we have some provisions in the law for health promotion, but they are quite weak, and that health promotion is also detached from general policy making. For example, currently our government is about to liberalize alcohol law, which is likely to cause a lot of problems and a lot of cost. But that kind of policy making is detached from social and healthcare policies, which is really a pity. So I think this health promotion is very important, but then the tricky thing is how to provide financial incentives for health promotion and promotion of well-being. And probably this is something I could ask you, Sonia. What do you think? How this health promotion should fit into the financing system? Because that's a kind of a difficult area, because if we are really successful in health promotion and promotion of well-being, that would mean less work for the professionals, or at least they would need to switch their emphasis in their work, and they are not always welcoming that idea. Mm-hmm. But thank you very much for sharing your thoughts, and I wish all the luck for your initiatives. In Finland, it took probably 20 years to reform the system, and it's still the implementation is still underway. So please be patient and work hard to make this happen, because it'll be a great success when you finally have some legislative steps towards your initiative. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. I think health promotion was more popular in the 90s when I started to get into the system, and I was studying health promotion, and we lost it the last 20 years. And I'm watching other countries, and I think it's in other countries as well. And without these regional, without strengthen the regions and give them power and the money and the management of the money and the organization of health care, social care, I think without that, it won't work. In Germany, we are far away to think the way what I was presenting, because we are so closed in this health insurance and doctors associations thing, in this Kollektivvertrag, collective contract. But there has been a movement going on for 20 years already. It's coming more and more up that the regions and politicians say the providing has to be local and regional, because local we can see what we need, yeah. But that would mean that you change the system, and then it comes to the question of power and money and who says what's going on and what is to do. Everybody had to be changed. The health insurance system, we have to change it. Yeah. The insurance companies have to change. We are, I think, the only one who are able to calculate and to count and to manage the money thing. Because to manage such a national fund, I can't explain the German healthcare, the financing system would take too long here right now, but it's huge, And you must redesign everything. Otherwise, you can't divide the money. You can't create, design a new money welfare mix. And this is what we need. We pay all the money on treatment of illness, but we do not have public health and prevention. So everybody is talking about that. You won't find any statement without "we need prevention," but it does not happen because the structure, the architecture won't change. And the change, of course, means for one associations, they will lose money. It's a money thing. And what makes me hopeful is the new generation of medical doctors. They say we want to act, we want to survive, we want to work in teams. We want to be interprofessional. We want to be employees. We don't want to run our own residential praxis. They have different meanings how they want to work. And this is what makes me hopeful. But it's a hard change, but you have to rethink the whole design, the whole architecture. Otherwise, it won't function. And that means that politicians have to understand that we have to think in public health. Yeah. And that again comes to the problem. The benefits will not pay off in their political career term. And this is, I think it's a problem everywhere. Yeah. And yeah, but we point it out. And what else can I say? Rethinking what makes me hopeful again is with the digitalization and the new methods of calculation. We don't have to calculate, you know, by pen and block. We can do a lot of modeling. So that means we can develop iterative. Usually in Germany, you only negotiate. Yeah. You sit on the table and you negotiate, but you never develop things. And this is a problem of how it comes to policy and politics. And we need corridors. Without fighting, we only fight about salaries. This is what we do in Germany. Yeah. We only fight about salaries, but we never develop regions. And I think a lot of people know, and there is a lot of literature, a lot of research, but nothing changes because to point on doctors, on medical doctors, nobody wants to do this. And you are very easily put into the corner. Hey, you are a doctor basher. Yeah. You are bashing medical doctors. No, we are not bashing medical doctors because a lot of medical doctors are not satisfied with the system. Yeah. But they don't get out of it on their own. And the new generation of medical doctors who are in the power, who have all the power in Germany, they are not politicians. They don't engage themselves in the self-government associations of the doctors. They just step out because it's so frustrating for them as well. And yeah.
Thank you, Sonia. I think we can continue this in the panel. It's really, really interesting. And I think it's going quite deep to the grounds of how we are organizing things. And one of the reasons why we organized this webinar was that we were wondering that why in each country we think that our system is the only one and it's very difficult to change in any country. And still we have very different systems in different countries. Why don't we learn from each other? So maybe we will continue the discussion on our digital platform. Please, you can have each a separate platform separate to this. But I think it will be really inspiring for us to hear Professor Medical Doctor Mats Brummels from Sweden. Next, he is the founding director of Medical Management Center at the Karolinska Institute in Sweden, in Stockholm. And I think it will be an interesting discussion now, because he's also, I think, would agree quite a lot with Sonia's speeches, maybe not in everything. Welcome, Mats.
Good afternoon, everybody. For a while, I thought that I would have to change your perspectives very radically. We have so far been discussing nations and systems, but I realized when listening to the previous presenters that as soon as one moves to implementation, you need to start acting locally. And my presentation will give you a kind of clinical case or a presentation of from care organizations on a local level. Before doing so, I will try now to share my screen, and hopefully we'll be able to find. Care integration has been a major policy objective and a professional challenge for more than 20 years. And it has been also one of the major objectives of the Finnish healthcare reform, which was presented earlier during this webinar. If you can move on to the next slide, please. All right. So in terms of integrated care, we at the Medical Management Center have been had the privilege of studying two different organizations with different approaches to integration. We call them structural versus functional integration. But I think, especially when I refer to policy and policy objectives, that there is a kind of preceding form of integration, which I would like to call administrative integration. If you have the slides, dear audience, in front of you, I'm now moving to the third slide. I would make the case that what we experience in Finland right now is still something I would call an administrative integration of services, which is based on a political vision. And it's mostly seen in forms of merging political committees and municipal administrations, which was done in Finland already 20 years ago. The present reform is an example of structural integration. And it's basically a question of merging provider organizations. And in the case of Finland, merging healthcare and social services organizations. What you can achieve by structural integration is basically to remove administrative barriers. What I then call functional integration is based on multi-professional collaboration. And even if one can achieve by structural integration to remove administrative barriers, functional integration arrangements show that there are still cultural barriers, especially between health professionals and social service professionals. If you have read my abstract, you already know that the study which I will be presenting was in many ways a disappointment. And that's why I would like to further develop the concept of integration by referring to extended integration. I will give you an example of what I mean with extended integration, and also make the argument that the findings of our study points that that's what actually is needed in order to achieve true integration. I'm moving to the next slide, and I will briefly describe to you the two organizations we have been studying, as I said, since the early 2014. They are kind of natural experiments The first one is a merged healthcare and social service organization in a municipality in the northern parts of Region Stockholm. There was a threat that the local hospital would be closed. So the local community then started an action and were able to persuade both the region and the municipality to, as an experiment, merge the healthcare and social services into one organization. As the hospital services were included, psychiatry was naturally a part of this new organization. We have looked specifically at what happens in mental health, because you can easily argue that people, especially with long-standing mental health issues, are those who can benefit the most from integrated services. Originally, now, this change was pretty successful. In Sweden, psychiatry or specialized healthcare has been the task of the region, whereas social services, including housing, social support, but also care for the elderly and disabled and people with long-term conditions, were and still is a responsibility of local authorities, that is, municipalities. And in this case, one important administrative barrier was removed. We found that this merger in psychiatry services was quite successful, mainly because of the dedicated manager, a psychiatrist, who saw the importance of including all professional groups into the organization. And she also, by organizing educational activities, was very keen on increasing the professional status of those working in social services, and managed in creating good collaboration. The second example is from the south of the region, where the department head of psychiatry and the social services director came together and decided that they were responsible for shared clients, and they wanted to do something to improve the services. So for almost 25 years, these champion leaders were able to create a fruitful collaboration between psychiatry and social services. And their services were co-located. And another important part of their service model was that they formed pairs of coordinators, one from psychiatry, the other from social services, who then took responsibility for their clients. So each client had a pair of coordinators that they communicated with. As we originally defined these two organizational configurations, as I call it, as pretty successful, we wanted to compare them to an ordinary psychiatry clinic, which didn't have any formal collaboration arrangements with these two other organizations. And we wanted specifically to look at to what extent we could see possible differences in terms of successful coordination of services. We had the possibility to interview both staff and patients. We made the quite courageous decision to focus on psychosis patients. The majority of these patients were young patients with schizophrenia. And this obviously now provided us with a specific challenge research-wise and we had to trod very carefully. We performed semi-structured interviews and directed content analysis of those interviews. And obviously, this is a small study, so we have to interpret the results with caution. I'm now moving to the slide which gives you a summary of the observations we made based on the interviews with staff. Interestingly enough, what staff focused mostly on were the obstacles that they faced in their practice. They told us that, for instance, meetings between different professionals and professional groups were difficult to arrange. They pointed to a lack of standardized communication and traceability of information. In Sweden, there's still different legislation for healthcare and social services, and it's not possible to share information as freely as would be important in terms of coordinating services. There were also evidence of what they called misalignment of actors. And we could see that in the organization where social services and healthcare were working in the informal collaboration, that over the years there was a blurring of professional boundaries. And to give you one simple example, we could find cases where psychiatry nurses would do shopping for the patients. Probably a good service to the patients, but not necessarily what is the most efficient use of professional resources. And they also brought forward that even if there was a good understanding on the shop level, there was not necessarily a functioning collaboration on the top management level. What they did raise, though, was that in terms of beneficial factors, they emphasized that when you have the possibility to work in smaller groups, in collaborative communities, and focus on local service provision, one could say the smaller the organization, the better the cooperation. Then our interviews with patients and relatives show that the patients and the relatives, they appreciated the attitudes of the staff and the fact that they, by and large, saw patient and family involvement as something which they appreciated. We have earlier today been talking about co-production, and this is an example of that staff indeed also find co-production as an important thing and important to try to achieve. What patients and relatives also brought forward was the fact that, yes, it's important that social services and healthcare are integrated, but the arrangements did not cover very important services like the social insurance agency, the employment office. Please remember that we were talking about young patients with mental health problems. And in Sweden, those two agencies are governmental agencies and not part of either the region or the municipality. They did say that co-location of services is beneficial, which is kind of self-evident. What was disappointing, though, was that neither of our interviewees made any references to the organizational arrangements. So we draw the conclusion that the organizational configuration had little to do with how the patients had experienced the care and service provided to them. As the example of the government agencies not being covered tells us, that formal organized collaboration addresses only part of the challenges with integration or non-integration. Now, this rather disappointing finding is actually corroborated by a fairly large literature review made by Rutgers, finding that integrated care arrangements, by and large, are not more effective in providing coordinated services than ordinary care. The most important observation made was that for all of these three organizational configurations, the case manager was the most important service integrator. And we also found out that very often it's a relative who has to be the case manager. Now, disappointing findings, and I have to obviously to emphasize once again that this was a very small study. That's why I'm going to theorize a bit towards the end. But by and large, what we need are two types of extended integration. An integrated care system should include essential services also outside social and healthcare. And it really now points to the importance of a well-informed case manager. And secondly, the integration is not successful if not patients, we can call them clients and users also, and their families and friends and social networks are involved in a true co-production arrangement. And this will be dependent on two theoretical concepts, institution and agency. With institutional pull, I'm referring to a multi-professional collaboration which is based on professional pride and a true commitment to these patients and clients who need their services and their professional skills, and realize that the users best benefit when professionals from different groups work together in order to provide a comprehensive service. That's what I call institutional pull. But I also think that it's important that we see well-informed patients and relatives as agents. And just to give you, if you move to the next slide, hopefully you have them in front of you, I present a dictionary definition of agency. It's the capacity, condition, or state of acting or of exerting power. And we have ample evidence that the better informed a patient or a relative is, the better are the chances also for not only an improved quality of life, but also medical outcomes, even in life-threatening conditions like cancer. So, in conclusion, our small case shows that this extended integration can be best achieved in the local community, and with engaging local providers who interact in a multi-professional collaboration in co-producing services with patients and relatives. We have also shown the importance of including the social network which would involve actors like neighbors, voluntary organizations, and the civic society at large. In palliative care, we have something called compassionate communities. And my final argument would be that we need to have compassionate communities for all patient groups needing integrated services. Finally, to paraphrase, and I think this is very important to pay attention to also when the Finnish health and social care reform now moves from organizational changes towards implementation of new practices, that the local, that provider organizations and local communities are given more leeway and possibilities to both design and carry out the changes needed in order to create more benefits to both patients and the society. And finally, to paraphrase, I would say, think courageously, act locally. Thank you for your...
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Max. It was really, really interesting and many nice phrases that you use, like the compassionate communities and extended integration and professional pride. I like that as well. But now we have this stupid commentary by Lisa Maria Voipio-Pulkki, who is the steering committee chair of the European Observatory on Health Systems and Policies and former director general of strategy in the Finnish Ministry of Social Affairs and Health. So the floor is yours, Lisa Maria.
Thank you very much and good afternoon. And thank you much for an excellent presentation and the opportunity to read your paper. I don't have slides, but I have written notes. And I will first address a little bit the background of the study or the scenario and then go more into some more detailed comments. Well, you probably know that acute psychosis is one of the most painful medical conditions and requires appropriate psychiatric care, of course. Prognosis is highly variable and total recovery is unfortunately rare. The number of psychiatric hospital beds has been dramatically reduced over the years, highlighting the importance of outpatient care and vertical psychiatric care coordination. This has been the case in Finland and I believe in many other Western health systems. Severe psychiatric disorders typically begin during early adulthood, as it was the case in your study. These disorders have profound and long-standing consequences in several areas of life, including work, social relationships, cognitive challenges, and stigma. And since the 1970s, I think, as you mentioned, variable community-based comprehensive treatment programs have been described, they have become popular, and so to say, proven effective. And particularly supported employment models have yielded encouraging results. Roughly one third of those eligible patients have been employed during these projects, also here in Finland recently. However, not all patients are lucky enough to benefit from such programs, and they have also been criticized of not being truly patient empowering. And I believe that the paper just presented by Mats addresses the needs of these most vulnerable patients with chronic psychosis. Your paper is a thought-provoking qualitative study of perceived grassroots-level service coordination and its dependence or independence of organizational health and social services integration. Well, knowing the nature of chronic psychosis, it is almost common sense or self-evident that care coordination must cover all aspects of life, described by the authors here as extended integration. Whether such support can ever be good enough is another question. Frustrations and disappointments are common, but that's not the point of the study. Well, the interviewed staff members listed many recognized problems in the everyday life of our healthcare facilities. Some should be very easy to tackle, such as attending coordination meetings as agreed, while others are more challenging, such as managing unclear professional boundaries or legal and technical obstacles in information sharing. From your paper, although it's not directly written, one gets the impression that these obstacles have been there for some time and nobody has really been able or mandated to take action. As you much already said, it's quite unique that you interviewed also patients and their relatives. And I quote, "Patients and relatives describe that well-coordinated care was facilitated by having a professional contact person with a helicopter view." In the discussion, you also suggest that also the informal caregivers, more or less voluntary family members, should be involved and supported accordingly. And as was already said, neither patients nor staff made any reference to organizational arrangements. Does this mean that organizational integration does not matter at all? Well, as was already stated, we must note that in Sweden, healthcare and social services are provided by two different public authorities. In Finland, these two sectors were merged by law 2 years ago and their funding combined. The well-being service counties have arranged health and social service coordination in various ways, and many problems do certainly remain. But at least there is now easier to build joint service units and share client data between authorities. There has also been some legislative initiatives to make this data sharing more simple. It's not synergistic yet, but it's better than it used to be. A national study on the implementation of comprehensive psychiatric community care models is actually indeed underway. We don't have the results yet. However, I would like to say that one size does not fit all, and not all psychiatric nor any kind of patients need or can benefit from comprehensive extended integration. There are many reasons and mechanisms why and how the benefits of organizational integration could be materialized in other patient groups and clinical situations. And I do think that particularly this aspect of the reform, it was actually a great incentive of the reform. It needs further follow-up, evaluation, and also academic research. And it came to my mind that this natural experiment between Sweden and Finland would perhaps be worth comparing in an academic study. Finally, the authors claim that the results are relatively independent of context. And I agree that this could be true in this patient cohort. The most vulnerable patient groups like these are in many respects our key customers. They test our ability to deliver. And in this respect, I do believe that at the end of the day, it's all about people, about caring, experienced and compassionate professionals who actually do make up the backbone of any health service system. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Lisa Maria. Wise words. Do you want to comment back?
Well, thank you. It was a very nice summary of the article. and I couldn't have done it better. And I don't think you made any real counter arguments. I do agree with you. And that's why I think it's so important that we strive for service co-production and involve patients and relatives in planning and decision making regarding all care. That is the most important condition for securing that we have a patient or person-centered care. That would also hopefully mean that there is not an over-organization or or inclusion of services are not really needed or appreciated by patients and relatives.
It's true.
Finally, I would like to reiterate some of my final statements, which I think are specifically relevant to Finland, and that has to do with the need to move rapidly towards enabling local communities and local provider organizations to take responsibility for making all the changes needed in order to accommodate to the fact that the government now is belt tightening. I don't like the phrase cost cutting, because in reality, the government funding is still increasing and will increase over the years. But relative to the needs, there's a profound pressure now on the welfare counties. And I think it's extremely important that, and I could make a reference to other studies we've done in Sweden on the importance of decentralization and to moving now the power of resources to the front line. And hopefully that would be the next step now, which the newly elected political representatives will start pushing in their welfare counties. Well, maybe somebody would say this is a kind of political speech, but it's based on studies we've done in other areas of Swedish healthcare.
Thank you very much. And if I may still add one point, you said several times that your study has a small sample size. That's true. But you also said that the material was satirized. So there were no new aspects popping up from the interview. So I think this is an example of how a small size qualitative study can still be valuable and add our understanding of the topic. Thank you. It was great to read.
Okay, thank you. And I remind that the paper is available, and it's also on our website and our digital platform, the link to the paper. And now I would like to invite Minna Kivipelto as our last speaker, last but not least, professor of practice at the University of Jyväskylä. She is the professor of practice in social work. And welcome, Minna.
Thank you very much, and have a nice afternoon. I try to share my presentation. Maybe I can start now.
Yeah, please do.
And my title is "What Enables Real Social Work in Adult Social Work." And Päivi is trying to share my presentation. The second slide is about this subject. And I will talk about the study titled "What Enables Real Social Work in Adult Social Work," and the subtitle is "Examining Mechanism-Based Explanations." And we have conducted this study together with Professor Aila-Leena Matis, and this study was published in the European Social Work Research Journal last year. And my starting point is that, our starting point was that the social work faces many challenges almost daily. And we can hear about the complex situations in social and healthcare. And most of the discussions have been around how various administrative measures caused by new public management restrict the practice of ideal, or as we called it, real social work. And me and Aila-Leena, we met social workers from one local adult social work agency where the social workers felt that they were allowed to assert their professional ideas, ethics and standards in their work. So we started to call this agency as Lucky Lakes. And this sparked our interest in exploring how we can gain deeper insight about what enables this kind of social work in Lucky Lakes, how they can act accordance with their professional ideas, even though the system seems to be quite bad at the moment. So this led us to formulate the research question: what kind of mechanisms enable social workers to uphold their professional ideas, and what social work standards despite the pressure of NPM? The third slide. Here you can see the theoretical background we used in this study. We applied critical realism, which was used as a background theory, as it is fundamentally allows the identification of mechanisms that either support or hinder the goal attainment in social work. So we are not only interested in results, but also these mechanisms that support or hinder the action in social work. So we decided to apply the chimera theory, which is a blend of critical realism. And this chimera theory has been developed for social work, especially within the context of critical realism. And according to chimera, outcomes or results in social work are directed and shaped by context, actors, interventions, and mechanisms. So there are different parts in this work which we should analyze. However, since our focus didn't involve direct interactions with clients when we mentioned interventions, so we were generally referring to the actions and the operational approach which within the organizational context of real social work. And the fourth slide, there we are explaining the method we used. So we collected the information by two focus groups, interviews, supplemented by reports from BDP workshops and the research teams, reflection sessions as background information. And the first interview interpreted the positive practices observed within the Lucky Lakes adult social work team as the desired result, and explored also the context where it happens and actors which were playing a part in this activity. And the interventions also that together with the mechanisms may explain the achievement of these results, as we call it, the real social work. And the second interview conducted at the end of the project, collaboration with the five facilitators of the local adult social work teams, and it was testing the results using a so-called counterfactual analysis. And this is some kind of special methods in critical realism. I would like to explain it a little bit more. The counterfactual reasoning refers to the analysis of what we can imagine with each question, what could have happened under different conditions if we take certain mechanism away. So if we found some kind of mechanism which was supporting or hindering the goal attainment, this real social work, we took the mechanism away and imagine it, is the result going to be the same without this mechanism. So this is called a counterfactual analysis. And we also used some kind of supplementary material, some kind of reports from PSP workshops, and team's reflection sessions, but also some statistics. And the fifth one, here you can see the analysis we made. So the qualitative data consisted together nearly 50 pages of transcribed interview texts. And using the chimer theory, we focus on the following aspects in the data. The results, we observed high employee commitment and low staff turnover among social workers in Lucky Lake's adult social work team. So this was called real social work. And the context where this was happening was the usual context in Finland. Also, these agencies were taking part of two big projects where they were also discussing about social work and developing the social work. So we had to take account of these two, that they had these projects going on. But otherwise, the municipality was quite ordinary municipality and social work agency. And actors were identifying the key actors in the situations where this real social work was possible. And those mechanisms are the main issue in our research. So we tracked the mechanisms that enabled real social work. And we had this model for identifying mechanism-based explanations in real social work in this article. And next, I will, in the next slide, I'll tell you a little bit more about the results. And also, Alalena, you can comment if you find something I can't remember, because it takes time to remember these things. So we found five mechanisms. And I would say firstly that the mechanism is quite a large amount of things. And this is one of the reasons why this critical realism and chimer theory is quite difficult to use in quantitative studies, because we have to find these mechanisms through counterfactual analysis. So the first one was called role-taking mechanism, and this mechanism enabled an active search for dialogue and promoted the transparent role of social work in the society. So this is some kind of active role mechanism in social work, and this was possible because this team has gained valued status and close collaboration with the local community. So they could act quite actively, and they had met policymakers, other professionals, non-governmental organizations, churches, and small and medium-sized enterprises too. So this mechanism was promoted as social workers maintained regular meetings with policymakers and other agencies. And the partners also had high trust for each other, which make this mechanism possible. For example, social workers had municipal negotiations twice a year. They had an audience with the council to discuss their work and raise awareness about their activities. And the second mechanism was called response mechanism. It increased recognition and appreciation of adult social work by the local community and adult social work partners for its active role taking. This was a little bit closed mechanism one, but this was much more also about the increased appreciation of other partners, but also respectful attitude towards social work clients. And this mechanism was very important, and they worked a lot to gain respect also to the clients. Yeah, I read some citat from the one social worker, which said that I have noticed, for example, in our organization, such as the decision-making bodies, the association board, for a few years, no such concepts have been used in speeches like drunkards who go there, or when they drink, they drink their money first. This type of discussion, it hasn't been there for a years. So the respectful thoughts about the clients were also important. They were taking with them. And the third one is organizational autonomy and responsibility mechanism. This triggered autonomy and flexibility, emphasizing discretionary power and responsible accountability. And this was very important also, this one, because social workers were working with the clients, they were moving, they were not just sitting in the offices, so they had a very low hierarchy, and this kind of working, they felt very good, and it raised their feeling about real social. The fourth one was the team spirit, and the social workers particularly highlight that they had a very good team spirit. And this was kind of a spirit which enabled that they worked together, they were moving together to different places, and also they felt that this is one of the attraction and cohesion making mechanisms. And the last one was this critical consciousness mechanism. And this is quite important in social work, settings like home visits, outreach social work, and collaborative groups of experts were using this critical conscious mechanism. And they felt that the greater the involvement with clients' lives, the better they knew about how to change the situations also of the clients' lives. So this was felt very important mechanism. So the seventh slide I have here, the key takeaways, what should we think about these results? So the first one is that these administrative structures and policies in social work, our opinion is that they can be interpreted in various ways. At the moment, we hear a lot of this new public management and area and low amount of resources and that kind of dialogues. But in our study, we noticed that there is also many different ways of thinking about social work. And we were happy to find these mechanisms. We are not 100% sure are these mechanisms the objective ones, but these are summary of the speeches of the social workers. And now we can say that there are some kind of mechanisms which will be stressed in social work if we want to put social workers to do what they can do best. And also the effectiveness of social and healthcare services is quite complex subject, and it's quite difficult to analyze only with outcome measures. We would like to use more measures which are based on critical realism, constructivism, and other this kind of philosophical thoughts that we can gain the more the surface, get to the deeper places of this structure. And the critical realism kind of theory, they are not very easy to use, but they help to delve beneath of the surface. And we think that these explanations were rather good. And the challenge, of course, there are some challenges in this method. It's it takes time, and the methods, and also we had quite a few research available on conducting this counterfactual reasoning, but we were quite happy to do it. And also in the last slide, you can see some key concepts and their abbreviations. So we have used them quite a lot in this research, and you can see them more closely there. And in the final slide, there is the reference, which I used in this diagram. Thank you very much. And if you have any comments, and if Alalena wants to say something, be free to comment. Thank you.
Thank you, Minna. And I think it was a very interesting and complemented the other presentations quite well. We have now invited Paula Rossi, a senior researcher from the University of Vaasa. She is an expert in public management and service public service systems. And please, Paula, welcome to share your thoughts and comments.
Okay, thank you so much for the presentation, and also for the invitation to deliver this commentary. It's a great pleasure to be here. I really was inspired by Minna's presentation, and I hope that I can share some comments and ideas that I find really interesting. First of all, I think that the presentation kind of encapsulates quite well what enables professionals to act according to their professional ideas or identities, like despite the service system and the way that the service system operates. And I find that the interest in mechanisms that enable or hinder the actions or decisions, I find that really an important topic to address. But related to, I think, most closely to the organizational autonomy and responsibility mechanism, I'd like to share some kind of reflections and learnings from our previous study. It has just been published. We studied the policymaking agency of social service professionals when they were implementing and using a new client information system in social services context. And we focused on the conditions that influence the policymaking agency in public service ecosystems. And what we found out was that the professionals working in social services have and are following their quite strong professional identities. And when asked, or when they are asked to change the way that they work, for example, when they are asked to implement a new information system and use that in practice, they are quite keen on maintaining their institutional arrangements. So they are quite reluctant to change the practices that they hold dear and they want to follow. They often want to make individualized choices during everyday work. And I think most importantly, in social work, the professionals often wish to foreground client-centered work practices. So that is kind of the heart of their work, everyday work, that they are doing their work and following their professional identities that encourage them to actually foreground the client and their needs. And also they are meeting in their everyday work and when implementing these new information systems, for example, they are meeting these technical and legal limitations that the system kind of delivers to them and to their everyday practices. So coming back to what enables real social work in practice, one could argue that social service professionals want to foreground lived experiences, practice-based knowledge, and person-centered care. So my question is to Minna and or perhaps to others too, that what needs to be done at organizational and institutional levels of the service system becomes more important than the focus on actually to the work of the professionals who are actually keen on following their the person-centered care and these kind of lived experiences and foregrounding the needs of their clients. This is also related to the administrative structures and policies that Minna raised in her presentation. So what should be done or what needs to be done in organizational and institutional levels of the service system to actually enhance or enable the professionals to use their person-centered professional identities in practice? So it's a tough but quite interesting question, and I would be delighted if we could touch upon that a bit at least today. Thank you so much.
Thank you, and Minna.
I'm not sure if I can answer this question, but in this seminar, we have heard that it's good what comes to funding. It's very good that we have these broader shoulders, as we have heard. But what comes to effectiveness from the client's point of view, these broader shoulders are not very good. We need smaller units. And also what comes to autonomy and the real social work and working in a way the clients need, we need quite small units. Also Max gave this idea and Bob also talked about these things. So my opinion is that even though the funding is these broader shoulders, we should focus now to this grassroots level where the real social work and healthcare happens, and how can we support these professionals to do the work they can do. Not the bureaucracy, not the administrative things, what they are doing a lot in these days. But this is a leading question, and this is also a political question. I don't know if I answered, but this is my... Okay. Yeah.
So perhaps I can add something. I think that the reason why we started this study was exactly this, that there was so huge difference in these Lucky Lakes compared with other municipalities and communities regarding the how social workers like their work, because others did say that sorry, we couldn't do now anything in this project because we are just working as fire brigade and no time, and our work is more and more standardized from above, so we cannot take the freedom to develop it ourselves. And also they were lacking staff members all the time. So many positions were vacant, and they were lacking qualified social workers in the organizations. And then there appeared this one organization where they didn't have these problems. They didn't have so much lack of staff members. And when we asked them how it comes, and some of them we got this wording, real social work from the social workers. They said that I'm happy to drive 60 kilometers in one direction every day to work because there I can do social work, real social work. So this was for us the reason to go and look what is it and what makes it. And I think that It's on that all what Minna said is true. It's also the autonomy, and also, for instance, they had 8 hours per month time for doing something else than working in the office. Going into the community, organizing, contacting with clients, groups, with citizens' movement, and so on. I don't know if that would still be possible in the shortage of resources, but it was somehow also the nice mixture of being very client focused and working in a somehow equal basis with service users, respecting their knowledge and the information about the living environment, saying we can understand people only if we know the environment and the local conditions. And then on the same time, knowing the structures. So it was not only looking on individual cases, but always seeing them in the structures and in the context. I think that was also very, very important.
Okay, thank you. And I think there will be many issues to discuss in the panel discussion, which will be in a short while. And before the panel discussion, I would like to allow the panel presenters to see what has been updated in the digital platform, and maybe some collect their own ideas as well. I will show you now our digital platform. I hope you can see it now. So in this platform, you can see that we have here different pages. This is the welcome page where you come when you click the link that you have received in your email. And then there is a separate seat for each of our presenters today. And as you can see, there are some discussion which has started on these pages. And also I just now uploaded the presentations there in PDF form. And you can go to this discussion and see it. There is Finnish and English side, but if you go and click to this me and translation, you can select your own language from there, how you read it. But I ask you to write either in Finnish or in English so that most of us want to are able to read both of those. And here we will have this general discussion where we hope that you will share your own ideas and your own comments in general on this this page. So maybe we will continue in 5 minutes after you have been able to see a little bit what's in here. And Teppo Kröger, professor at the University of Jyväskylä, will be chairing the panel. And all our presenters, Mats and John and Minna and Sonia, well, please be prepared for the panel in starting in 4 minutes now. Okay, so I think we are about ready to start our panel discussion, chaired by Teppo Kröger, who is a professor at the University of Jyväskylä and the director of the Center of Excellence in Research in Aging and Care. And he has a very unique research group in the University of Jyväskylä. So Teppo and your panelists, please continue from here. Can I?
Thank you very much, Päivi. Very happy to participate in this last part of this interesting webinar. Great to see you again, John and Minna as well, and very happy to meet you, Sonia and Mats here. And well, you know that the kind of the big main title of the webinar of today has says something about successes and failures. And I would like to start with this kind of a warm-up small question that what do you think from your own perspective, what makes a social or healthcare system a success or a failure? You don't, I'm not expecting a full analysis of all possible factors, but could each of you please raise up some issue or some issues that you think that are really central, whether our care systems are successes or failures. And maybe we can follow the same order, so maybe John could say a few words first.
Yeah, thanks, Teppo, and lovely to see you as well. I think there's two things for me. First of all, in the UK, a lot of the we've inherited a lot of historical approaches and services that were designed probably with a sort of 1940s, 1950s aspirations and lifestyle in mind, and they're increasingly unfit for purpose in terms of how we live other parts of our lives. And often we try and make people fit around the different health and social care services that we've developed, rather than more fundamentally try and change those services so they fit around the reality of people's lives and communities. So I think there's a lot in there about what success would look like and about what holds us back. Secondly, just at a national level, in England in particular, we've had probably several decades of failing to fully reform adult social care. Policymakers have started that debate, and then they've realised it's a little bit too difficult, and they've stopped and they've left it to a future government. And our current government seems to be doing the same again. So there is a real lack of political commitment and imagination, I would argue. So a failure on one level. But in the work that we do with Impact, we work with community organisations, municipalities, practitioners, community organisations all over the UK. And there's so much passion, innovation, great ideas, people making such a difference to colleagues and to the people who use their services and local communities. It's a major success story. It's really small and local and bottom up. So it's quite easy to get depressed when you look at the big picture because it's so kind of stuck. But actually, when you talk to people about what's happening under the radar and at local level, it's a series of really inspiring success stories, really.
Thank you. Thank you. How about Sonia? You were very critical of the current German system.
Yeah, I would close up to John. We don't adapt. We stay in the same, and is what I think pointed out. And it's success is if it fits to the time. The German healthcare system is a very good acute system, acute care. Yeah, but it has changed. We now have the chronic illness. You all know this morbidity things, etc. And we don't move with the system, with the needs. And what I'm more on failures, I think. But the failure is very easy. We don't see the purpose. We don't figure out the purpose and the target. We don't know what we are doing, what we want to do. And if you don't have the target, it's a lot of activities. It's a lot of activity and a lot of things going on, a lot of money wasting actually in useless projects, contracts, because the whole competition and market thing, the deregulation things came over the last 30 years. I think this is failure. We don't have the target. We don't know what we want to have. This is failure.
Yeah, thank you. How about Mats? What would you say? I know that you have also been very much involved in the Finnish reform in its different stages, being an expert, key expert behind some discussions. But how would you define or see the key issues in this respect?
I think we should be proud of the Nordic welfare system. And it's very like much like the English NHS. So I think we are in good company here. But the fact that our social and healthcare system is comprehensive, it's public, it's under democratic control, means that the population feels a true ownership of the system. And this is essential because as it's tax-based, citizens need to feel that this is actually part of an important resource in their everyday life. Having said that, I think connected to this comprehensiveness lies a failure, which I would link to the governance system, which has been centralized and bureaucratic. And once again, I think we share the experience with the UK. And the introduction of new public management didn't get away with the sort of the main problem with centralization. It actually included a number of new challenges, with too narrow of a focus on performance targets, to take one example. I have already talked about the importance of autonomy and the possibility to make decisions in the front line. And in terms of governance, I'm very intrigued by the professions researcher, can't remember his name now, who talked about professionalism as the third logic in addition to bureaucracy and market governance. So it all points in the direction of creating more leeway for practitioners and professionals. I really also paid attention to the fact that Minna raised the importance of autonomy also when discussing a good social work practice. So this would be my recommendation that, and I kind of repeat what I said towards the end of my own presentation.
Well, repetition is often necessary, but how about Minna? What would you like to say to this question?
The microphone is open.
It's open.
Okay, thank you. It's nice to continue after Mats because I highly agree what you said. And especially if I would like to lift something which I didn't talk in my presentation is a quite good integration of services and benefits in Finland. We have made quite good system in Scandinavia totally, but I know better this Finnish system. It's quite a criticized also that the benefits and services are not very integrated, but my opinion is that they are more integrated than many other countries. It's also criticized at the moment due to the ongoing social services, social security cuts, which our government is doing at the moment. So I'm afraid about these cuts and these doings that they are making this good system worse. But in a large picture, this integration of services and benefits, it's sort of innovation, which we should hold on to go, and the integration needs to be studied more, especially what's good in this system, what should we stress more, and what we shouldn't take off. Because there are some black holes also, and I have found those when I've been working in the Finnish Institution for Health and Welfare. But I really hope this integration would go better, not worse.
Thanks, Minna. Well, one issue or one problem that Aila-Lena already mentioned in the beginning of the seminar is the recruitment of staff in social and healthcare. As we know, the care needs of the aging population are going upwards, but how to get enough staff and where to get it, and how to keep them in the sector, I think that's one of the key issues. So, like to hear if you would have some ideas that what could we do with the recruitment crisis, as it's called in several of our countries, and maybe we could go in the opposite order. So maybe Minna could continue a few. Points on this. I know it's not an easy question.
It's not easy.
Let's collect some ideas.
Some ideas about those from this our article. This is enabling the real social work. We should not do. We are doing quite a lot, sort of micromanagement at the moment. And the professionals, they are not liking that one. They don't want to be micromanaged. So they are highly professionals. They know what they are doing. We should let them do what they want and what they can do. So I think this is quite a lot of leading question, and also educational question. We should turn this questions to the educational items too. It's not only about the money, but there is lots of doing from these working conditions and how you respect your professionals as a leader. I think these are quite interesting and very important topics. Everybody's talking about the money, but that's not the main question, I think. But
yes,
some ideas now.
Thank you. Yeah, actually, I another question was that what can we do if we don't have the adequate financial resources? But you already raised this up that even if we don't get more resources, so what can be done? But maybe Mats, it would be
yes. I would
some of your ideas.
Yes, I agree totally with Minna, and I think we need to get rid of micromanagement, and we need more of professional leadership, which I mean professions-based leadership. All the important decisions concerning resources and also the potential impact must be based on a professional assessment and decision, and that's why I wanted to emphasize the need to introduce professional as the third logic, and Friedson is the name of the sociologist who presented this idea. But I would want to emphasize the importance of retention. I think it's hopeless to believe that we will be able to recruit masses of additional staff to healthcare. You know, it's as easy as we can't educate more than half of the younger generations to work in social and healthcare. We need to have them in other parts of the society as well. I would like to make a reference to the Norwegian personnel healthcare personnel commission, which a couple of years ago published a very insightful report, telling upfront, we are not going to have more staff. Let's think about how we can make the best of the staff we have available, which then gives us some indications of the importance of both paying attention to priority setting, but above all, to change practices in order to make better use of the resources, to have cost effective practices as the main goal of organizing services, which brings me back to the need for professions-based decision making and leadership.
Thank you. How about Sonia? What would you suggest?
Well, I said we have enough stuff actually in Germany, but we use it totally wrong. As I said in my presentation, if you are an examined nurse and you need a prescription from the doctor to put the compression stockings on in outpatient care, and I could tell you a lot of examples. We in Germany, we are quietly bad organized. So, and we need to organize the care services new, better. And the what Ailalina's said, the professions must be allowed to act professional. So this is what we cut out all the time. And this is quite deep in all the old contracts and pillars. This is what I couldn't explain properly, but it's all in there. It's all law, old-fashioned law. And this we have to lift and to work out. It's not the money any longer. It's quite well paid. But the staff, nevertheless, they leave their jobs because the circumstances every day are so that you just can flee out of the job.
Thank you. And finally, John, what would be your take on this issue?
Yeah, I think there's three things, Teppo. So first of all, there's something about the social changes that are needed. So I think we don't value disabled and older people enough in our society. And so therefore, we don't value the people who work with them. We don't see it as skilled work. And we tolerate underfunded services that are funded to the bare minimum to provide a basic safety net. So we need to see social care as a form of social and economic investment that we make in ourselves as a society to help us all lead the kind of lives that we want to lead. Secondly, I trained as a social worker, and social workers are quite good at complaining. And so we've got 130,000 vacancies for care staff in England at the moment. And we tend to say, and I caricature this a little bit, but we tend to say, "Oh, please, you know, the social care, a lot of the roles are poorly funded. They're very stressful. There's not enough training and development. There's no career progression. There's 130,000 vacancies. It's awful. Please come and work in social care," which isn't a very good way of advertising the role. Whilst you could say, you know, care is amazing. It's what makes the world go round. It changes lives. It changes the life of the person you're supporting. It changes your life. You know, yes, there's loads of problems, but there's 130,000 opportunities to make a difference. Why would you not want to be involved in something as amazing as care? It just helps to reframe the nature of the discussion a little bit. And then thirdly, I wonder if we need to be a little bit more imaginative. So I sit on the board of a very large hospital trust in my city. We've got four hospitals, about 24,000 staff, and they've invented a new role called a nurse associate that is qualified and trained to a similar extent to a nurse, but not quite a full nurse. They can do some of the things a nurse could do, but only so many of the things. And people often come in to work in facilities or to work in catering, for example, in the hospital. And then they're trained and supported to work on the job in care roles to become nurse associates. We've got a number of very deprived communities around one of our hospitals, and a lot of people, there's very high unemployment rates. And people might come from some of those deprived communities, be trained up, get their qualification whilst working on the wards as a nurse associate, and then they can come back to become a full nurse in the fullness of time. There's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people on these programs. They're fantastic, fantastic members of staff. It's encouraged completely new people to come into healthcare who would never have been able to train as a healthcare worker before. It's made a massive difference in terms of the socioeconomic well-being of some of those people, families and communities. And it's just tapping into a lot of those communities that were on our doorstep before and just thinking slightly more imaginatively about what's possible. Because of the pressures social care is under, we don't have anything like that in adult social care. You just scratch around for you know, to try and fill the role. So I do think the scope to be a little bit more ambitious and a little bit more imaginative, because these are, you know, these are tough jobs, but they're brilliant jobs as well. And they could be such a route into social mobility as well as providing the kind of care workforce that we need for the future.
Thank you. That was a lot, many interesting ideas and perspectives. Well, the time goes very, very quickly. I would have several questions for you, but unfortunately we don't have time for that anymore. But I still want to ask one question or a double question, I would like you to be brief, to only give two sentences for this final question, and that the question is that: what is in your mind the most important lesson or take-home message that you would like to highlight for the future policy making or reforms of social and health care? So the questions are: what should be avoided and what should be done? And one sentence for each of the two part questions. So maybe we follow the same order, go from John to Minna in this order. So John, what are your two sentences on this final note?
Yeah, thanks, Teppo. So if you're a policymaker or a leader and you can't make something better, then at least don't make it any worse. And then secondly, care is about people and it's about relationships, and all the solutions to all the issues that we've talked about today are about building different and better relationships. We often approach these as technical issues and they're actually human relationship-based issues.
Thank you, so John. And how about Sonia?
Nah. I would say don't be afraid of shaking the architecture and be brave to do this. And it's about people, yeah.
That was very brief. Well done, Sonia. Thank you. How about Mats?
Focus on cost effectiveness. Have trust in the professionals. Stop micromanaging.
Thank you. And finally, Minna.
So we need a grassroots. Without grassroots, we don't have these broader shoulders.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And thank you all members of the panel and the speakers of today. I think we are now coming to the closing of the webinar. It's been a 3-hour session, actually quite a long session, but I think we have heard a lot of very interesting and important perspectives on social and healthcare, the problems, but also the approaches that could take us forward. I think reforming social and healthcare is not easy because actually these systems have very strong path dependencies. They are very strong and long institutional and structural continuities in these systems, and it is really very difficult to make major changes. They don't happen overnight. They like we heard also from Heikki Hiilamo, that the reform that is now being implemented in Finland has been prepared for 2 decades or more. It really takes a long time, and even then the reforms might not be perfect in the end, that they still need to be redesigned and developed further when they finally are become real. We have heard about resources, financial resources, staff resources. We can see the staff is very key resource, the professionals who are working in the system. There's no service system without the professionals, and they are the experts who know how the system works, and without their knowledge, it's very difficult to develop it further. On the other hand, we come from the research community, and we see that we also need the knowledge that is produced by research and researchers, and we need to have many kinds of knowledge, quantitative knowledge, qualitative knowledge. We also need more and more knowledge coming from lived experiences of users of these services and their family members, which, like we heard in several presentations, this knowledge has not been very highly used or valued traditionally in social and healthcare systems. So this is very clearly a very, very key challenge. One thing that we didn't really have time to discuss today is politics. Actually, our social and healthcare systems are politically created. They are based on the decisions of political decision makers, and they continue to be so. And every reform will be politically decided. How to really integrate politicians and democratic decision making into reforming and these systems, and into the knowledge produced by professionals, researchers, and users, and family members. I think this is a key question, and it's not easy. Sometimes we might feel that politicians are actually making more trouble, a bit like what John referred to, not producing solutions. But this is something that we cannot really get rid of. The whole system is based on political decision making, and maybe it is good that is the case. Anyway, we have some keywords like resources, staff, knowledge, user influence, but maybe also politics that are fundamental to our social and healthcare services, both now and today, and also for the reforms and the developments that are needed and that all of us are trying to promote in our own roles. Thank you very much for a very interesting webinar, particularly to our keynote speakers and also for the commentators. And I give the word back to Päivi, whether you want to officially close down the webinar.
Well, thank you, Teppo, and the panelists. They're very, very inspiring. And I think the webinar reminded us that although we don't live in a perfect world, we do have means to make it better, at least a little by little. And I want to encourage everybody to continue working together for that purpose. And we will have our digital platform available for the rest of this month. And all the presentations are there, and you can continue discussion there, and it will enable also those people who have not been able to join today to continue discussing there. And please visit that and share your ideas as well. And thank you for everybody, and let's continue our good work.
Bye bye. Thank you.
Bye bye.
Hey, thank you. It was so exciting.
Bye bye.
Bye.